Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce magazine. My first two articles that I'm going to share with you today are from a section titled Letter Perfect. Family correspondence captures the magic of everyday life in the voices of those we love. And the first article is titled Bridge Across Time, and it is submitted by Kim Babcock of Chittenango, New York. When we children were 3, 4, and 5, our father died in a car accident. Through the years, a lot of people have shared their memories of him, which was comforting. They described what a kind, thoughtful family man Justice Laverne Riddall was, and they said that his relationship with my mother was true love. Though I wanted to know more, I couldn't because I lost him at such a young age. I collected all the stories about him in a corner of my heart, trying as a child to piece together this man who was my father. I do remember a few brief moments of him, like snapshots. As I grew up, I kept the image I had of him close. Flash forward 50 years when his mother, my grandmama, whom I was close to, passed away at 103 years old. We had a special relationship, and she told me lots of stories about her eldest son, my father, whom she called her buddy. Upon her death, I was cleaning out her house, and in her cedar chest I found amazing treasures, among them her wedding dress and pressed flowers. But the true gift was a store of hundreds of letters written by my father, starting when he was a child at Boy Scout camp, up to his time in the Army in Alaska. If you truly want to get to know someone, read their letters. My father wrote of missing family and friends, but also of learning independence and becoming a man. The letters were to his parents, grandmothers, siblings, and my mother. They included little things like Thanksgiving dinner menus, photos of the mountains, and newspaper clippings. It was fun reading how my parents' relationship grew and how he struggled to decide whether to wait until he finished serving or marry while on leave. He was sure they should wait until he changed his mind and they married July 5, 1958. It was enlightening to learn how my father pushed himself in his classes, always driven to do his best. Twice he was awarded Officer of the Month. He was very proud to be given an award over his 8,000 fellow officers at Camp Richardson in Alaska, which led to him being chosen to present actress Mary Martin with information on a totem pole carved by a local tribe. His sense of humor was apparent, too, because it turned out he knew very little about the artifact. He had to study up on its history quickly. I do not think there is any way to express what the loss of a parent does to a young child and the peace that you feel is missing throughout your life, but I hope I conveyed the extraordinary impact the written word from loved ones has on us. May we never lose that as we rely more, may we never lose that as we rely more on technology in our ways of communicating. My father's letters to his family were a bridge across an abyss and filled my heart with joy. My second article from the Letter Perfect section is titled Love, Lefty, and this is submitted by Laurie Pegler Mallon of Park Ridge, Illinois. Shortly after our dad passed away in 2011, we came upon a shoebox of letters dated from 1946 to 1948. It sat untouched for decades in an attic. The box was a treasure trove of correspondence between our father, Donald Pegler, a 17-year-old soldier in the Army in 1946, and his family in Chicago. While the bulk of the letters were written while he was stationed in Japan, his service in Texas and Washington, as well as the voyage to Asia, were also documented. Apparently, his parents and Grandma Pearl saved every letter, photograph, and cartoon. The collection depicts the life and imagination of a young soldier. We learn how he coped with ailments from scarlet fever to ringworm, insatiable hunger, and extreme weather. He describes being severely injured when he drove a Jeep into a wire tied across the street. It was priceless reading about the friendship he forged with a Japanese teenager. He talked about the similarities he noticed between American and Japanese life. He also covers maintaining old high school friendships and his experiences with other soldiers. He writes of fellow soldiers' struggles, of his high school girlfriends, and of the ruins and beauty in the places he visited. Even the small surprises delighted us. For instance, Dad always insisted that he didn't eat candy, yet his correspondence proves that he was quite a fan of candy and fruitcake while he was in the service. The letters often feature little cartoons he drew that further explain situations he writes about. But even more profound than the content itself is the obvious familial connection maintained among the young soldier, his parents, and his grandmother, whom he always called Graham. In a top drawer of his dresser, we found a sketchbook of his Army experiences. The beginning of his sense of humor, for which he was known as an adult, is there on the pages he composed as a teenager. We collected his correspondence and sketches into a family book called Miss You All, Love, Lefty, which is how he signed many of his letters. Our dad returned home to marry, raise 7 kids, and thoroughly enjoy a lifelong career in advertising. In 1962, he joined Foot, Cone, and Belding in Chicago, where he used his skills as an illustrator and his sense of humor for one of the agency's most successful campaigns, the Raid Bug Ads for SC Johnson. In 2015, the Museum of Broadcast Communications named the Raid Bugs as one of advertising's 10 greatest icons. From the food trend section, Hooked on Goldfish, Little Crackers Cross the Ocean, and this is by Natalie Wysong. Admirers of Swiss ingenuity, nibble on this. In 1958, Oscar Cambly, a biscuit maker in Switzerland's Emmental region, invented a fish-shaped snack in honor of his wife, a Pisces. Entrepreneur Margaret Rudkin, founder of Pepperidge Farm, tasted the little crackers while touring in Switzerland. A foodie who got into the bakery business when she developed a homemade bread for her son with food allergies, Rudkin sought out old-world recipes and premium products to add to the Pepperidge Farm line. She introduced Goldfish to the United States in 1962, where they've become a top-selling snack, munched on by everyone from the Kindergarten Snack Brigade to the Happy Hour set. Now we're going to dive into some numbers. 3. The number of medals U.S. allies awarded to Ralph Hauenstein, Nazi codebreaker and goldfish cracker equipment manufacturer. Hauenstein wanted to help countries rebuild after World War II. Inspired by a German baker he saw creating fish-shaped crackers, Hauenstein developed equipment to mass-produce the little snacks. He shared the cracker-making equipment with the baker and also sold it to Pepperidge Farm for millions. 2. The number of items on Julia Child's pre-meal Thanksgiving menu, goldfish crackers and her own version of martinis. 35. That's how many years it took before goldfish cracked a smile. In every bag, only about 40% of the little guys are grinning. 1937. The year Margaret Rudkin founded Pepperidge Farm. Rudkin baked her first loaves in her Connecticut farmhouse kitchen and then expanded into the family's garage. Rudkin lowered production during the war so she wouldn't have to compromise on the quality of the ingredients. By the time the company moved into a custom-designed plant in Norwalk after a decade in business, Pepperidge Farm was baking 40,000 loaves per hour. 25 cents. The price for a loaf of Pepperidge Farm bread when the going rate was 10 cents. The health bread made with stone ground wheat and local honey had an instant following. 1.7 million. the distance in miles goldfish traveled in 1988 when the crew of the Space Shuttle Discovery took the crackers along for an out-of-this-world snack. 608.3 million. Sales for goldfish crackers in 2019. The flavor-blasted variety such as Bursting Barbecue and Extra Cheddar were hot sellers at 175.6 million. 28 million. The amount Rudkin got for Pepperidge Farm when she sold it to Campbell Soup Company in 1960. Rudkin became Campbell's first female board member. And last, dozens. Original, Cheddar, Graham, Explosive Pizza. Goldfish come in lots of flavors, including limited and seasonal editions. And next, from the Brush with Fame section, Laurie Brennick Rollins of Ochusett, Massachusetts, submits an article titled, Surprise Arrival at the White House. My first time on an airplane was to visit my cousins, the Dudleys, in Cheverly, Maryland, in 1979. Cousin Ed, as I called the father of my cousins, Karen Ann and Terry, worked at the communications center inside the White House and was authorized to take us on a private tour. Ed was on a first-name basis with everyone we met walking down the long hallways. We just exited the Oval Office when someone pulled Ed aside to tell him the president was arriving. "Let's go," Ed said. We hustled onto the White House lawn where brass stations and crimson ropes coiled the gathering crowd. Men in suits and dark glasses holding walkie-talkies ran onto the lawn. We covered our ears and squinted as a helicopter landed on the carpet of green. Then the door opened and the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, stepped out. First Lady Rosalynn Carter joined him from the White House and together they greeted the people who gathered on the lawn. I took photos with my little camera. Ed pushed us tightly against the silk rope so that we could shake hands with the President and First Lady. My photos turned out grainy. But about a week after I got home, I received a color photo of me shaking hands with President Carter. Ed had tracked down one of the official photographers from that day to get the picture for me. I'll always be grateful to my dear cousin Ed for making the first of my many life's adventures the most memorable. And now here are some facts about James Earl Carter, Jr., our 39th president. He was born on October 1, 1924. Jimmy Carter graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1946 and served on the nuclear submarine Seawolf. He resigned in 1953 when his father died. Carter was elected president on November 2, 1976. He served one term and was defeated in his second run by Ronald Reagan in 1980. In 2002, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his humanitarian efforts. And from the Keepsakes section, Antoinette D'Amora of Bethpage, New York, submits an article titled, Bucking the Trend. Somewhere around 1949, at the age of 4 or 5, my husband Joe received a very interesting and enduring gift from his paternal grandpa Andre, a metal riding horse Joe named Mobo. That was the maker's name stamped on the stirrups, and Joe kept it. Mobo riding horses inch along slowly when the child presses down on the stirrups. It's hard work, but at least it's a fairly safe ride. We still have Mobo. We like to say in our family that everyone gets to own Mobo, but for a short time. All children get to enjoy the ride and wander over this antique and rather noisy mode of transportation. After all, Mobo is aged, so he's cranky. Joe loved Mobo, but his lasting memory of the toy is how his brother Vic, who was 7 years younger, used to turn Mobo upside down and fiddle with the stirrups, wheels, and gears, waking up Joe every morning with the racket. The boys shared a bedroom in a Bronx apartment, so there was nowhere for Joe to escape the noise. Mobo entertained our daughters, especially our youngest Maria, and then Vic's children. He was back with Maria for her children for a while, and now he's with Vic's children, who each have kids of their own. Mobo will outlive us all. We've never touched up or replaced his paint to preserve his original look. He ages naturally. And here is some additional info on the Mobo Bronco. The Mobo Bronco ride-on horse, like the one owned by the D'Amoras, was a popular toy made by the UK's D. Siebel & Company beginning in 1947. Siebel toys were in high demand in America, and in 1948, the company set up a subsidiary in New York. Mobo toys ceased production in 1972. Today, vintage Broncos can fetch high prices on online auction sites. One was listed at $1,300 recently, but most start around $250. Russ Makey submits an article for the classic cars section titled Over Hill, Dale, and Everywhere. General George Marshall called it America's greatest contribution to modern warfare. GIs called it the Jeep, a nickname of obscure origin that may have come from a Popeye cartoon or a light tractor Minneapolis Moline sold to the Army before World War II. The Jeep put the American military and its allies on wheels. After World War II, the Jeep settled into civilian life and morphed into the first sport utility vehicle, the Wagoneer. But the mission that inspired its creation in 1941, to take you anywhere you want to go, lives on. Today, Jeep is Fiat Chrysler's most popular brand in the United States, with more than 900,000 sold in 2019. The original concept came from American Bantam, a manufacturer of small vehicles that occasionally served as props in movies. Its Bantam reconnaissance car won the War Department contract, but the plant couldn't meet demand. The government sought more makers to roll out the vehicle in large numbers. Willis Overland and Ford were the main Jeep makers in World War II. Ford called its prototype GP. Some speculate the Jeep name is a sounding out of those initials. The two companies produced about 650,000 Willys MB and Ford GPWs, their respective labels for what were essentially similar vehicles. Willys trademarked Jeep after the war and hired designer Brooke Stevens to adapt it to civilian use. Stevens, the man behind Oscar Mayer's iconic Wienermobile, created Jeepster and later Wagoneer, which was produced without fundamental changes from 1963 to 91. Before the Jeepster, Willis was sold in 1953 to industrialist Henry J. Kaiser, who entered the car business after building Liberty ships for the war effort. He dropped production of his unprofitable Henry J. and other cars and concentrated on marketing Jeeps. Kaiser Jeep was sold to American Motor Corps in 1970. Chrysler acquired the brand when it absorbed AMC in 1987. And now from the Last Laugh section, June Karneski from South Milwaukee, Wisconsin, submits an article titled The Queen of Spin. My sister Mona and I loved to ice skate on a small pond near our house in the 1970s. We were teenagers and enjoyed pretending that we were Olympic gold medalist Dorothy Hamill. In my family, skates were an extra, something I needed to earn money to buy for myself. I'd found a pair of black ones at a rummage sale. Only boys wore black skates, but they were all I could afford, so I brought them along to the pond. Mona acted smug about the white skates she'd borrowed. Our Aunt Lucy lived nearby and sometimes met us at the pond. We figured that at 36, she was much too old to skate. When I brought out the black skates, she noticed how I frowned putting them on. She asked me if I wanted to wear hers. I looked at them. They were the right size, but they were fire engine red. My black skates were bad enough. Red ones were out of the question. No way, I said. So Aunt Lucy laced up her red skates and stepped onto the ice and began to skate. Mona and I gaped. In the middle of the pond, Aunt Lucy pirouetted like the ballerina in my jewelry box. With all eyes on her, she skated backwards, spun, and jumped. Some kids started laughing at her, pointing at the red skates, but Aunt Lucy just smiled and continued to twirl. Embarrassed at the spectacle of our skating relative, Mona and I kept our distance. The kids continued their behavior until Aunt Lucy skated up to them. She said something we couldn't hear, but then they stopped laughing. Their expressions changed, and they watched in awe. Back in the warming shack, we asked Aunt Lucy what she said. "I told them that I was a professional skater for Holiday on Ice," she said, "and that I wore the red skates in last night's performance." We all had a good laugh at Aunt Lucy's made-up story, and we learned that red skates and a little white lie can make you a star. Robin Duffy of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, submits an article for the Lasting Impressions section, and it's titled, "What Will It Be, Dad?" Nothing pleased me more than when my dad called me from the den where he was watching TV. "Hey, Rob, make me a gin and tonic, would you?" This may seem like a questionable parenting of an 8-year-old, but I love the feeling of importance in performing this special chore. And he always had just one. I'd run to the barrel-shaped liquor cabinet. Its brass latch was heavy and the door was hard to open. Inside, it was dark and sweet-smelling. There was no telling how old the schnapps, bourbon, and vodka were. Most of the liquors were from the days when Mom and Dad entertained before they had children. I liked the purple velvet bag that held one bottle and the tag hanging around the neck of another. I put it on my arm, pretending it was a bracelet. Best of all were the bone-shaped swizzle sticks, topped with skulls and gemstone eyes. I carried the big bottle of cheap gin to the kitchen, where I climbed onto a stool. I put ice cubes in Dad's special highball glass, then gin, two fingers, then tonic. He didn't bother with limes. One final step. Give it a swizzle. Who knows how long I spent mixing to get his drink just right, but my father was patient and never made me feel rushed. He took a sip. With pinky finger extended, he looked at me and declared, "Perfect." Once, when Mom happened upon this ritual, she looked disapprovingly at Dad and said, "Duff." Without batting an eye, he replied, "Well, I didn't tell her to drink it, Ida." One time he did let me taste the drink with its pungent sting of juniper. Once was enough. Our next article is entitled Rhodes Trip. Six wonderful floors beckon the family to the city, and this is submitted by Wynn Crombie of Huntley, Illinois. We took the bus downtown from the suburbs outside Tacoma, Washington, to go shopping in the 1940s. My mother, Madeline, let my brother and me roam in our favorite sections of Rhodes Brothers Department Store, but she took us through some uninteresting parts of the store first. The men's department was on the first floor. There, everything seemed to be only in white. Handkerchiefs, shirts, boxer shorts. The ties came in sensible colors. Women's clothing on another floor was more elaborate, but woe to the shopper who was tall or petite. No special sizes. Sequestered in the back corner of the first floor was the least exciting section of them all, sewing notions. There my mother bought scissors, assorted buttons, tape measures, and pins. This was also where she discreetly shopped for dress shields to sew into the underarms of her outfits. In cahoots with notions was the fabric department, which for some reason was on a different floor. Once past these trials, I could wander in the music and book sections I loved. The white-gloved elevator operator moved us from floor to floor by turning a big golden wheel. She'd trill, "Up car, going up," sometimes overshooting a floor before getting us back on track. She knew where everything was located in the store and dutifully recited the contents of each floor. Rhodes Music Department had record albums for $1. Sheet music was also available, and there was even a clerk willing to pound out the melody on an old upright piano. In the book department, I could buy a Nancy Drew or Hardy Boys mystery for 75 cents. Most fascinating of all was children's footwear, which had an X-ray machine. I tried on Oxfords, always Oxfords, and slid my feet into the machine, looking down through the window at my murky green skeleton feet. This was the scientific way to determine if the shoes had enough growing room. When it was time to pay, my mother handed over her Rhodes charge card. The clerk placed everything in a cylinder and pushed a button. The cylinder whooshed away to the hidden depths where such things were taken care of. A few minutes later, the process was reversed, and the cylinder returned, bringing the receipt. "Hun," my dad would yell to my mother over the My dad would yell to my mother on the first of every month, "Where's the Rhodes bill?" Our Rhodes card was the only charge card our family had, and Dad paid it off diligently. Rhodes got a few modern touches over the years. In the 1950s, they added a revolving front door. We kids went around and around until some adult came to show us the error of our ways. And when Rhodes finally ripped out its stairs and installed an escalator, there was a big to-do. We rode to the top on the moving stairs, hoping that our feet wouldn't disappear into the mechanism. No trip to Rhodes was complete without a visit to the soda fountain on the mezzanine, where they made the best ever hot fudge sundaes. Long gone, Rhodes is only a distant memory, but a happy one. And here's some information on big box stores. American officials in the 1950s began to backpedal on domestic trade laws that looked out for mom and pops. Big companies were allowed to get volume discounts, ushering in the age of retail's markdown giants, Walmart, Target, Kmart, and Kohl's, among others, all opened their first stores in 1962. Shoppers willingly accepted a lower level of service than they got at the department stores that reigned Main Street, since the goods were similar and the prices were lower. Walton's Five and Dime opened in 1950 in Bentonville, Arkansas. It was a winner and inspired owner Sam Walton to launch a discount chain with the first store in neighboring Rogers in 1962. When the chain expanded into other small cities, it kept rural customers as its focus. Wide aisles, fast checkout and parking for 1,200 cars. The Dayton Company planned for a new way to shop at Target, its proposed discount store in Rosedale, outside of Minneapolis, Minnesota. The S.S. Kresge Company's success was built on affordability. It operated five and dimes and $1 stores. In 1962, the company opened its first discount department store, Kmart, in Garden City, Michigan. By the end of that year, they'd opened 17 more Kmart stores. Maxwell Cole was a successful grocer when he opened his first department store in Brooksville, Wisconsin. We've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. And I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reminisce is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.